Hey everyone, I'm Thanos Davelis, and welcome back to The Greek Current, a podcast by the Hellenic American Leadership Council and Kathimerini, where we highlight the top stories of the day every afternoon with analysis from guest experts, policymakers, journalists, and HELC staff. This past Thursday marked the five-year anniversary from the failed coup attempt that took place in Turkey, which has since reshaped the country. The Erdogan government has used the failed coup attempt to reshape the country's policies, institutions, political landscape, and foreign posture, cracking down on dissidents both in Turkey and abroad. David Lepeska joins The Greek Current to discuss his latest piece in The National, where he explores the changes within Turkey over the last 5 years, looks at how Turkey has exported its crackdown on dissent to other countries, and considers why Erdogan may not be able to cash in on the failed coup for much longer. David Lepeska is a journalist who has contributed to The New York Times, The Guardian, The Atlantic, and other outlets. He previously served as a foreign correspondent for The National. For the past decade, his reporting has mainly focused on Turkey. David, welcome on to the Greek Current podcast. It's great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me. Hello.
David, looking back over the last 5 years, just how drastic has this change been when we look at Turkish politics and society?
Well, President Erdogan had begun to persecute and go after critics and dissidents before the coup. There was some of that. In fact, I myself was kicked out of the country for my reporting a few months before the coup, but it led to a sea change in just how much effort was put toward silencing almost any kind of critics. So the coup happened July 15, 2016. And in the months after that, 150,000 people approximately were purged from public service. Something close to 100,000 people were detained and arrested, and many of them put in jail. They were all thought to be members of the Gulen movement, a movement led by a Turkish preacher, Fethullah Gulen, who is in exile himself in the U.S. And the government went after these people. And because of these purges, many people who were linked in some way to Gulen or his movement fled the country. Something like 50,000 people fled Turkey. Meanwhile, it also cracked down on Kurdish movement, Kurdish political parties, journalists. There were journalists also sent into exile and now are running news organizations from exile. Just a massive, any criticism of the government is no longer accepted, basically, within Turkey. And something like 200 media outlets were shut down in the year after the coup. So Turkish media is about 95% pro-government now. There's only a couple outlets, newspapers, printed newspapers, that are willing to be critical of the government, in addition to several handful of online sites that are mostly based outside Turkey.
In your piece, you highlight how the head of the Turkish government's diaspora oversight body had urged Turks abroad to assist Ankara in its search for Gulenists, and how Turkey's intelligence agency released a smartphone app that allows any Turkish citizen in Germany to report anyone for criticizing Erdogan or his government. Can you expand on how the post-coup crackdown on dissidents in Turkey has played out outside of its borders?
Right. So as I said, some 50,000 people potentially linked to this movement fled the country. Many of them ended up in Europe, which has generally had open doors to people connected to this Gulen movement, which the government, the Turkish government, has labeled a terrorist group. FETÖ, they call it. And so since they see these people as terrorists who are now living freely in Europe, the government, the Turkish government, has made every effort to, at the very least, kind of keep these people in their sights and know what they're doing, if not find a way to detain them or capture them, which they have done in many non-EU countries that are willing to kind of bend to the Erdogan government's will. So one of these things the government does is, the kind of diaspora outreach body has events and outreach kind of memos and letters urging all members of the Turkish diaspora to keep an eye out for Gulenists, for FETÖ, as they call them, and to respond and to report them to the diplomats. And part of that outreach was this, Turkish intelligence created an actual app where you could not only report Gulenists, supposed members of this FETÖ terrorist group, but you could report anything suspicious that Turkish citizens did outside of Turkey, anything that was critical of the Erdogan government, you could report. And apparently it was used a great deal in the years after it was released. And I think it has since been banned in a couple of European countries.
As you mentioned, a lot of media outlets got shut down, and most media in Turkey is now pro-government. As a result of the coup, a number of journalists left Turkey, with many heading to European nations. What challenges do Turkish journalists living outside of Turkey face?
The first one that most people are aware of is Can Dündar, the former editor of a leading newspaper, Cumhuriyet, who within Turkey reported in 2014 on a convoy of trucks that crossed the border into Syria. And His reporting was that the trucks were from Turkish intelligence and they were taking weapons to the Islamic State, to ISIS or related groups. And the government charged him with, you know, leaking state secrets, and he was convicted. And there was a long trial. And during his trial, there was an assassination attempt against him outside the courtroom in Istanbul. And so at some point, I believe shortly after the coup, he fled the country. And in exile, he has kind of bodyguards always protecting him. He's always at risk. He wrote a piece in the Washington Post, as I mentioned in the piece in my national column, saying that he has heard word that the Turkish government may be plotting an assassination attempt on him or other critics or Kurdish activists within Germany or other European countries. And he pointed specifically to the Grey Wolves, which is the militant youth wing of the far-right ultra-nationalist nationalist movement party, which is the parliamentary partner of Erdogan's AKP. And so there is potential from reliable sources for some sort of attacks within Europe on Turkish citizens. And indeed, a Turkish journalist was attacked just outside his home in Berlin a couple weeks ago.
How concerned are European countries about activities by this group, the Grey Wolves?
Yeah, France banned the Grey Wolves late last year, I believe November. Germany, Belgium, and Austria are considering a similar move. There have been several incidents in which Grey Wolves have attacked demonstrators. One was a Kurdish women's demonstration. I believe it was in Vienna. And another one was in eastern France. Armenians were commemorating the Armenian genocide, the anniversary of the beginning of the Armenian genocide. And the Grey Wolves attacked that rally. And one of the wolves said, "Let the Turkish government give me $2,000 and a gun, and I will do what's needed to be done anywhere in Europe." And so, yeah, it's a major concern of European governments, but they can't do that much because technically Grey Wolves, it's not an actual group. The official Turkish name is something like Turkish Hearts, but they don't have members. There's no official membership. So banning the Grey Wolves, it's hard to enforce. It may not have much meaning. It may just be a symbolic gesture. We'll see how it proceeds.
At the same time, David, you write that Turkey is also working through its religious directorate, the Diyanet, to not only export its post-coup crackdown, but also to try to shape European Islam. How is this playing out, and what's the reaction from European countries?
So a lot of Turkish workers emigrated to Europe, starting with Germany, starting in the 1960s and 70s. And as the numbers increased, Turkey felt the need to help shape the Muslim communities in these places, and they built mosques. And the Turkish government, going back to the 70s and 80s, sent thousands of imams to European countries to help lead these mainly Turkish Muslim communities. And in the past 2 decades, since the Erdogan government has been in power, it has taken to using these Turkish-run bodies in Austria, in Germany, in Belgium, a couple other countries, the Netherlands, to extend its political views and extend its own form of Islam, such as, you know, urging people not to protest against ISIS was one example, happened in France, I believe, such as kind of subtly advising people that they should keep an eye out for Gulenists or they should support the Erdogan government in the next upcoming vote. So several European countries, particularly Germany, have moved to take away power from these Turkish bodies and create their own Islam, train their own imams, because most of these countries don't train imams. They're not in the business of, you know, creating Muslim communities. And so now they have to begin to do that because Turkey has taken such control, kind of, you know, not weaponized, let's say, but, you know, use these communities as a tool to extend its influence.
Is there concern about its connection with the Muslim Brotherhood as well?
Yes. A lot of those connections are unclear, but yes, Turkey, in partnership with Qatar, has supported a lot of Muslim Brotherhood-linked groups across Europe. It's hard to say exactly what is problematic about these groups. Like, do they aim to create a Sharia-dominated Islamic state in Europe? You know, do they intend to kind of create their own marginalized communities that maintain a conservative Islam? Nobody really knows what their agenda is, but yes, Turkey is definitely connected to and has invited Muslim Brotherhood members to Islamic gatherings, Islamic openings within Europe, and many governments are wondering what this is about. And, you know, I mean, the Muslim Brotherhood is from where a great deal of extremism is rooted. A great deal of the kind of terrorist world is rooted in the Muslim Brotherhood, but some countries consider the Muslim Brotherhood a terrorist group. So all of those connections are problematic.
As we saw this past Thursday, Turkish President Erdogan led a ceremony in parliament before attending other events last week commemorating the people who died during the failed coup attempt. Over the last 5 years, Erdogan has been able to use the tragic events that took place to justify a power grab and even labeled the failed coup a quote-unquote gift from God. You note, however, that Erdogan won't be able to cash in on this failed coup for much longer. Why is that?
You're right. It's a constant thing, not only coming from Erdogan from the top, but from his advisors, from his top advisors. They're constantly tweeting about the coup, the victory over the coup plotters, the problem of FETÖ, and linking. In fact, they have often linked the opposition parties, the main opposition party, CHP in particular, as well as the Kurdish party, to the coup plotters, just as a way to kind of make them all the enemy of the state, you know, not just enemies of the government or political foes of the government. And the reason I think that those times may be numbered is because poll after poll after poll in the past few months, in part because of Turkey's deeply troubled economy, a falling lira, something like 1.5 million people driven into poverty since the start of the pandemic in Turkey. All of these things are kind of gaining momentum. And something like four polls in a row, the AKP, the government in power, has gotten their worst ever poll numbers. It's something like 35% support now. And only with its parliamentary partner does it get anywhere near 50%. And even with them, it doesn't. So there's a very good chance that they're going to lose the next election. But with Erdogan, it's hard to predict what he will do. It's interesting, though, that while he is autocratic and authoritarian, and Turkish elections are not fair, the government party, the AKP, gets so much more airtime because of what I said before than the other parties, but they are generally free. Erdogan and his people have not yet manipulated elections, so they should be able to play out relatively freely.
David, thanks for joining us on The Greek Current. It's been great chatting with you.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks so much.
In other news, Turkish President Erdogan and Turkish Cypriot leader Ersin Tatar on Tuesday announced plans to reopen part of the fenced-off city of Famagusta in the occupied north of Cyprus. Tatar said authorities plan to lift the military status for part of the city, adding that 3.5% of the area will be granted civilian status. The Greek Foreign Ministry issued a statement condemning the plans, reiterating that they are in violation of UN Security Council resolutions. Turkey must immediately stop its provocative and lawless behavior and comply with international law, it said. On Monday, hundreds of Greek Cypriots staged a protest near Varosha against Erdogan's visit. Protesters said that Turkish Cypriots also joined the protest. Finally, Turkey's president said on Tuesday that his country will talk with the Taliban regarding Turkey's bid to operate and secure the airport in the Afghan capital, Kabul. Erdogan's comments follow Taliban warnings last week that Turkey should withdraw its troops from Afghanistan, along with other foreign forces. The group called Turkey's airport proposal reprehensible. Meanwhile, Erdogan has called on the United States to meet conditions, including financial, logistical, and diplomatic support, so that Turkey can run and guard Kabul airport after other foreign troops withdraw from Afghanistan. Turkey has been negotiating with the United States over a proposal to operate and secure the airport. That wraps up today's episode of The Greek Current. Thanks for tuning in.